What has been the relationship between the church and CORE in the last 25 years?
Well, the church has been supportive of CORE. Walter Carter, Griffin, Chance, the relationship has been beautiful. You see, the July 4th, jail in up at Gwin Oaks Park was shared in by CORE. We were jailmates with members of CORE and NAACP. Bob Watts, who's now judge, Juanita Jackson Mitchell served as counsel to get us out of jail. So it was really a concerted effort of all kinds of people. I'm not too sure we didn't have some communists. And I say communists in the finest sense of the word, not derogatory. And I'm not a communist, but they participated. Everybody was welcome. Anybody who was willing to get in the struggle, and CORE was in the forefront, and CORE got its money from the churches. Got its accommodations from the churches. So, the church has never had any argument with CORE. In fact, he doesn't like to tell you, but the president of CORE, Farmer, is a preacher and a graduate of Howard University School of Religion. His daddy taught a New Testament at Howard University. Of course, he doesn't bother with being a preacher, but if you ever watch the rascal, you'll see the preacheristic behavior in him. Very few people know that Farmer is a seminary graduate.
Yeah, I didn't know myself.
Yeah.
How about the relationship between the church and the Urban League?
Well, the church and the Urban League have historically been. See, the point is that the church, in most instances for black people, is the vessel out of which these things have come. So that the church has had no argument. In fact, the black church has been the only segment of the church that has been willing to participate. Now, I can understand that because the black church has been a part of the persecuted. So that we had no choice but to participate in things liberating.
Started by Richard Allen.
Yeah, Richard Allen, and of course there was this Garnett, who was Presbyterian. There's a man here in this town, Harvey Johnson, and others. So that it has to be remembered that the church mothered emancipation and still trying to do just that. Has no other choice but to preach deliverance to the captives.
Was the church involved in the Route 40 sit-ins?
Yes,
in the early
my
60s?
Lord. Some of the buses left this church and left other churches going on the march, on the Route 40 East and Route 40 West. Yeah. Not only that, but we provided the money for bonds to get folks out of jail when they were arrested, and acted in a conciliar fashion with the authorities.
Was there much, from just the newspaper articles, it seemed like the restaurant owners were, you know, almost fighting every inch of the way, and then they sort of got to a point that they tried some form of compromise. Was there much, was there pressure from the churches and pressure
I think there is a built-in pressure in the business community. When it starts losing money, that is the summum bonum of their morality. They get very moral and very acquiescent when they're losing money. Money is the name of the game. And I don't give them any credit for having accommodated change. They changed because they had to change. And you have to remember that looking over the shoulders of blacks in America, the millions of blacks looking over our shoulders in Africa, just see what's happening in South Africa today. And you see white university students marching on behalf of apartheid or the elimination of apartheid.
What was your reaction to the Cambridge riots of 63 and also of 67?
Cambridge was a hard-headed group of Eastern Shore people who didn't want to give. And I know I was down there. I talked to the city council, along with others, Frank Williams, Bob Newbold, Vernon Dobson. We talked to them, tried to civilize them. And I'll tell you another man that who may go unnoticed, but if it had not been for General Gelston, who is now deceased, a lot of things might have happened down there. But General Gelston was a smart cookie and was very humane. Was one of the best commissioners the police department Baltimore City has ever had. He was a smart cookie, and he was a decent man. And I'm sorry to know, you know, they came to an untimely death, died so young.
What was the, just to go back to Cambridge for a second, what was your impression of the power structure or the white establishment in the town and their willingness or unwillingness to go along with black demands?
The white power structure in Cambridge was unbelievably recalcitrant and mean. Everything that came to Cambridge in terms of improvement came by force. They developed Gloria Richardson and company. They wouldn't talk. They wouldn't think. They were post-slavery at its worst. We did everything we could. It became an arsenal, a hotbed. I remember one night a group of us went down there and we had to be led into the city and led out of the city by National Guard.
How do you compare that, again, if you know, with Salisbury, which is also on the Eastern Shore, is about 50 miles south of Cambridge, and from what I've read, it sort of was an easier transition or an easier time of it.
I think that I can only stab at that. You do have Princess Anne, a little college down on the Eastern Shore that's close by. You did have students going in and out. And then you had a more enlightened community down there. People that were not anxious to change, but changing on the basis of the signs of the times. And I think that accounts for it.
I think I was interesting some of the things I read of the differences, even though they're both Eastern Shore communities. I think it's an interesting observation.
Yeah.
Why didn't Baltimore burn during the 60s, as did other cities, for example, like in Watts or in Detroit?
Well,
or
Baltimore
Cleveland.
Did burn.
But it wasn't the massive.
It was relatively minor compared to. Well, you see, Watts is an all-black community,
right.
And there is no quote all-black community in the sense that Watts is. But my friend, I'll tell you that this town was incendiary. I was a member of the fire commission at that time, and I got a chance to see it. But here again, you'll have to remember that only 2% of black people participated nationwide in those disturbances. And I do not call them riots because they were not directed toward persons, they were directed toward property. When you talk about the Haymarket riots, you're talking about people versus people. In the Baltimore City, it was people versus property. And I would simply say that this town did burn. And I just recommend that you talk to more people about that, because it burned much more than I think that you are impressed that it burned, because I was in the midst of it.
Do you think McKeldin played a role in during the time? Did he play a role? I knew he came down and went through the part of the black community.
Well, just let me say this. The man's personal life enabled him at least to view it. He didn't cool it. Nobody cooled it. Time cooled it. And you say, why did it happen? It happened because the image of leadership in Mike King had been destroyed. And this was hopelessness's response. You kill a leader, you kill a general, and then you have the mob. As long as you have a general, you have an army. But in the absence of the general and the high command, there's a mob.
Did you see any changes in, I think we've touched upon this before, any changes in City Hall after McKeldin left office with the
Oh, yes, definitely. I still think of Tommy D'Alessandro as being concerned, youthful, and pretty much conscious of the time.
Who have been the main participants in the civil rights movement in the last 25 years among blacks? Has it been the middle class or the upper class or poor class?
I think there's been a cross section. You know, Furman Templeton of the Urban League, Lily Jackson, Juanita, Bob Watts, Chance, Carter, Frank Williams. I could just go on and on. There were men out at Morgan who participated, supported. Dr. Jenkins, the president of Morgan, gave support to the movement. The Ministerial Alliance, Chet Wickwire out at Hopkins. Believe it or not, Wally Alinsky was a part of the struggle in those days. So that you can't say that it was proletarian nor bourgeois. You'd say that it was just people who were sensitized to the great need and the insurmountable barriers that were there.
There's one
Mildred Atkinson. You know, as you think about it, there were white pastors. They've fallen away, though, but there were white pastors who got into the struggle. There was Rabbi Lieberman, God bless him. There was Monsignor Austin Healy. There was that little saint, Cardinal Sheehan. You know, when you begin to call a roll, it was everybody, the rabbis, the Catholic Church, Henry Alfer, don't forget Joe Connolly, and I've mentioned another saint, Morris Lieberman of the Baltimore Hebrew Congregation. These were great guys. I wish I could remember them all, but you know, you just can't. There were whole orders of the Roman Catholic Church that entered into the fray, marching. We assembled 5,000 or 10,000 people on Easter Monday in bitter cold on the march for Baltimore. Not the march on Baltimore, but the march for Baltimore. We had Jacob Javits to come down, Jackie Robinson. I was the chairman of that. Sam Daniels, you know, you just, of the Masons. I know I've left some out, but these are some of the guys that come to mind as I think about it.
There's one incident when there was some pressure put on local contractors in Baltimore to hire blacks in a short period of time. I think you may have been involved in that.
I was. Those were with the apprenticeable trades.
Yes, with the trades.
Raleigh Porter and Iuzzi. In fact, I've got Iuzzi's telephone number still in my Guido Iuzzi.
Yeah, the name sounds familiar.
Yeah, his telephone number then was 276-8500. In fact, I've got a number here. What was the vice president that was deposed? I can't think of his name right now. Agnew.
Oh, Agnew.
Yeah, I even have Agnew's number still in my file here. When, you know, his private numbers. And,
while he was governor or vice president.
While he was governor. It's interesting. I think I have it. I was looking at it the other day. Oh, Agnew's number is 647-6701. It was a private number. You know, those days we really.
Was there any friction with McKeldin over this incident with contractors and employees?
No. He encouraged it. In fact, I took the first black electrical apprentice on the job. I hand delivered.
What year was this?
I don't remember the year, but the boy is now, not the boy, but the man is now a licensed electrician. But before then, blacks were excluded from all of the apprenticeable trades based upon the grandfather clause.
What was your reaction to Agnew's speech in 1968 when he criticized?
Well, that's very obvious. All of us got up and walked out. That's just that. Agnew wanted us to do the impossible. Agnew wanted us to do what we weren't willing to do. Agnew wanted us to go against our grain. And incidentally, when we left Mr. Agnew's office, we came in here in this very low auditorium and had our meeting.
How do you account for his change? Or do you think it was a change? Because he seemed before this to be...
Oh, no, no, no.
Sort of
from the word go, Agnew was the least evil, so we thought, between George Mahoney and Agnew. We never had any great love for Agnew. But because of the incendiary remarks of George Mahoney, we had chosen to go with Agnew. But there was no love lost. In fact, Agnew told me in the presence of several people that whenever he saw me, Marion Bascom, coming, he was repulsed in his office. And I told him then that that was a problem he had to overcome. He was the most arrogant man I have ever known. And the truth of his arrogance will never be known, because his nolo contendere has obfuscated the possibility of I ever knowing, unless you can pull up some of the threads from his book. But of course, I'm not going to buy his book, because that will seem to increase his pocketbook, and I don't want to be guilty of that.
How do you view Mrs. Jackson's relationship with McKeldin?
Beautiful. Beautiful. And with that, you know, that Bible talk, that just got the old lady complete. But I think that if she saw or felt anything that was amiss in him, she would say it. I think that of Mr. McKeldin, it can be said that he did not agree or did not want to stamp his imprimatur on everything. Instead, I think that he knew that he was dealing with people who had minds. And there's another guy, Tucker Deering. Although he's been disbarred, Tucker Deering has been very active in the civil rights struggle. That name, you know, as you sit down, you forget about these folks. But Tucker Deering must not be forgotten in the struggle for human rights.
Yes, Judge Watts and Judge
Bob
Cohen,
Watts.
They mentioned Tucker Deering's name.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they did. Yeah. I'm glad they did.
A lot of people have. He's on the list. How about Mrs. Jackson's relationships with Mayor D'Alessandro III?
Was that the young Tommy?
Yeah, young
Tommy.
Oh,
yeah. They had no problems. No problem. She'd call him son, you know, demote him to a boy, and holler at him, and she took a notion. And in fact, she hollered at anybody. Now, I don't want you to think that Miss Lily was just a quiet person. She was aggressive, arrogant, demanding, commanding, insulting, but her overarching desire was to better the condition of what she called colored people. She never did get black in her vocabulary.
What was your impressions of Mrs. Jackson as a businesswoman? She was, I think she did have a successful real estate business on the side, or?
Miss Jackson was just a woman who had reared children. You know that her husband was either white or near white from Mississippi. In fact, I'm the one who saved him from getting killed out here today when some black thugs jumped on him. Right, this was the beginning of the old man's death, right across the street here on this alley. And this is, again, is the tragedy, that we do not keep our history and our personalities alive. They come on the scene and we forget about them. But again, you see, Mrs. Jackson, getting back to your question, Mrs. Jackson educated all of her children, which meant that her husband's chief source of income was operating a church-to-church movie. So he had no real income. And that's a part of the black matriarchy in our community. So she had houses. That was the only thing that she could do.
But this gave her sort of financial independence.
Oh, she had her financial independence and a base.
be able to participate full time with the NAACP.
Oh yeah, full time, Because
that's
actually, and I say this very honestly, the NAACP could not have paid Mrs. Jackson for the work she did, even if they had put her on a salary of $25,000 a year, would not have recompensed her for services. Hers was a 24-hour day thing. People knew to call Miss Lilly when they needed her, not only in terms of the civil rights struggle, but in terms of personal problems, police brutality, and that was flagrant in this town at one time.
Do you think there's been a desertion of the civil rights movement by some of its former participants?
No, I don't think that. I just think that there are some blacks who have forgotten whence, from whence they came, and money has a way of changing people's attitudes. You know, once they get up out of the barrel, they're busy gone about their business. And this is what frightens me. I hope that responsible blacks will not leave the fray to irresponsible blacks. And there are irresponsible blacks. And the newspapers, you know, always decide who the black leader is. This frightens me, that there might come the time when we'll be left with the radical fringe. And this is what the white community had better watch. They better listen to the sober speaking blacks. Because you don't have a unified black community anymore. It is as dichotomous as any other community. There's the radicals, the neo-radicals, and the not so radical. And then there are those who are just out of
it. Do you see any national Negro leaders or black leaders now that command any, command sort of the center ground of
I think that we still have black leaders. They are more separate now, because the legal aspects, the basic and fundamental legal aspects, have sort of served to throw us apart. I think now that there is a kind of evolutionary process going on, that is running the black community more into the political arena. We've got to have people who can vote for us, people who have power, and the ability to move people, sometimes when they have no consciences, is not in demonstrations. You got to have strong black people, congressional, state, and municipal governments. And although it's very quiet, you've got more blacks now in the political life of America than ever before. Southern cities with black mayors, comptrollers, city solicitors, where the action really is. This is the most hopeful thing we've got going.
I don't think there are any black citywide officials in Baltimore right now, are
no,
there?
No.
I think Milton Allen was the last.
Well, in terms of citywide, you have the judges who were elected.
Yeah, the judges, they're elected citywide.
I ran, you see, for the presidency of city council, but being a Republican, I lost. And yet I garnered 30,000 votes, spending about $5,000 in my campaign. I didn't even have money enough to buy automobile stickers or money to put on placards on buses or radio or television time. So that my defeat was based upon my poverty.